Most people probably would not have anticipated the price of gold to go up as steadily in recent weeks as it has. The culprits, so to speak, that are listed as driving the price of gold higher tend to be foreign central banks, the Chinese in particular. I would add to that the Chinese retail buyer that doesn't really have good other options. Real estate sucks. I think that's the technical term. The stock market doesn't do well, and because the Chinese economy is not very open, they're not making other choices. So that's probably a key driver there. Historically, I look at three groups of buyers outside of governments. It's the diversification buyer, it's the one concerned about the purchasing power, and it's the speculator. And until recently, I would have said the speculator is missing. The recent uptick we've had here in the price of gold might suggest that the speculator is kind of putting their feet back into the water.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm its founder and your host, Adam Taggart. The price of gold has experienced a breakout over the past month and a half. What does that mean? Is that a sign that investors are worried about higher inflation to come? Or that capital is fleeing to safety in advance of approaching economic trouble? Or is this price surge just due to speculative zeal? For answers, we turn to capital manager Axel Merck and his team at Merck Investments, who manage several funds that invest in the precious metal sector. We'll also ask them their thoughts on the future prospects of the gold and silver mining companies. Will their performance catch up to and perhaps outpace that of the metals soon? Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today.
Great to be with you, Adam.
Thanks, Pat.
All right, Axel. Well, look, our audience is should be very familiar with you, with all your appearances on this channel, especially the days that we have the FOMC minutes come out, and then Jerome Powell does his press conference, and you come on and make sense of it all for us. But today, you're joined by a couple key members of your team. I believe we have both Peter Miletus and Jamie Holman. Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having us.
And Jamie, thanks so much for joining us as well.
Yeah, good to see you, Adam, and thanks for having us.
All right. Well, look, Axel, why don't we just sort of start at the top here? I know we want to get to the miners in a little bit, but let's just talk about what's happening in the metals themselves. What is currently driving the price action in gold?
I think you said it perfectly in introduction. You said or, and I was about to say yes as the answer.
So it's really and.
Exactly. Well, I mean, gold does what it does, right? Or it doesn't do anything, actually, and the price is changing, and we are always eager to find an interpretation. Now, most people probably would not have anticipated the price of gold to go up as steadily in recent weeks as it has. The culprits, so to speak, that are listed as driving the price of gold higher tend to be foreign central banks, the Chinese in particular. I would add to that the Chinese retail buyer that doesn't really have good other options. Real estate sucks. I think that's the technical term. the stock market doesn't do well. And because the Chinese economy is not very open, they're not making other choices. So that's probably a key driver there. Historically, I look at three groups of buyers outside of governments. It's the diversification buyer, it's the one concerned about the purchasing power, and it's the speculator. And until recently, I would have said the speculator is missing. The recent uptick we've had here in the price of gold might suggest that the speculator is kind of putting their feet back into the water and might take an interest again in gold. And I'm not convinced of that yet. I mean, obviously, you can look at the CFTC speculators report. There is an uptick. But I think most of those are still with the meme stocks, the Mag 7 and crypto. But we see this is going to get their attention, the move we've had.
Okay. And this is something I've sort of been mentioning over the weeks that gold has been really coming to life here, is that at some point, Wall Street loves momentum, right? And so if the price action keeps going up, it's highly likely to start bringing in capital from the other sectors of Wall Street, where it usually hangs out and doesn't spend a ton of time in the precious metal space that much. And precious metals are relatively small market cap wise. certainly the silver market, and certainly when you get into the miners. But still, gold itself is small enough that if you had, some of the hot money that's been hanging out in the tech sector, the Magnificent Seven start to come into the space, a small percentage of the money that's in the Mag Seven could make a big difference in the precious metal sector, correct?
You see Jamie and Peter nodding. And by the way, you didn't give a complete introduction. They're really the brains behind what we do. I talk macro, but they roll up the sleeves and actually go out and visit the mining companies. And so they focus less on the price of gold, but they certainly are aware of how small this space is. And we'll talk about that probably a little bit more. The gold space, the physical gold space, is of course also very small, and a little bit of money can make a big difference. I don't like it as much when the speculators come in because that can exacerbate volatility. One area, by the way, I didn't mention it to just touch on that as well, is geopolitics. And I may have mentioned it on a previous occasion we've had to chat. I historically like to not talk about geopolitics too much because any flare-up due to a crisis, the market gets used to. What may have changed is that the long, relatively peaceful period we've had since World War II is coming towards an end. And what we see in Ukraine and Gaza are just symptoms of a new era that we're in. And if that interpretation is correct, then there might be a more permanent bit underneath the price of gold. And of course, in the purchasing camp that I mentioned, obviously fiscal policy and monetary policy plays a crucial role.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, one
So
thing, Axel, I think
go
is
ahead.
worth hitting on too is the breakdown in correlations, tips versus real rates, but then also ETFs flows, which also oftentimes are signs of the Western investor getting involved. And we've continued to see outflows in the gold ETF. Last year, we saw massive outflows, which with historical correlations would have suggested that the gold price was significantly lower. And then also with the TIPS correlation, the Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, what TIPS stands for. And that correlation with gold has also deteriorated since 2022. And those are interesting breakdowns because those correlations were very strong and held up for a very long time. So I think delving into that a little bit is interesting. And I think what Axel alluded to with the foreign central bank buying and then also some of the foreign retail buying, I think has been a large driver of that, but there's probably other macro factors involved in that as well.
Okay,
And just
great.
to add to that, just to add to that briefly on the diversification buyer, right? Historically, the price of gold has a zero correlation to the return of equities. It doesn't mean it's always uncorrelated. It phases in and out. In 2022, it didn't quite work. But we do see folks looking for diversification. They're concerned about equity valuations. And as equities go higher and higher and higher, those look for alternatives. Obviously, if the equity market does very poorly, that gets accelerated, right? Then really people rush, well, historically at least, have been rushing into gold as they seek diversification and presumably Federal Reserve stepping in to remedy whatever causes the equity markets to go down.
Okay,
Drill
so
down too on the Chinese buying, especially on the retail side. We just had a research meeting. We were talking about this, and I listened to a report this morning by PRC Macro, which is a Chinese-focused macro firm, and they delved into this in quite a bit of detail. And they kind of pointed out that maybe it's a larger factor than I had appreciated. And they talked about how the Chinese investor, as Axel has aptly pointed out, they don't have anywhere to invest. I mean, the real estate market has fallen apart, the equity market's fallen apart. And so where else do you put your money? They have these other structures that the government allows them to invest to that have started to deteriorate as well. And so I think that they've looked more and more towards gold. And the interesting part that I saw is historically, the Chinese have purchased their gold in the form of jewelry, and that has dramatically changed over the last couple of years. And we've seen the demand for gold bars and coins, which has gone up significantly. And they were quoting the data this morning, and they were saying that in 2022, there was 200 metric tons of demand from gold coins and bars, and then 300 metric tons in 2023. And then they're expecting 500 metric tons this year. In a global market of 3,750 metric tons a year. So that's a good size incremental demand coming in from that side of the market.
Yeah,
Did I
I'm
mention Jamie is a geologist and talks metric tons?
All right, a lot of questions here. First off, Jamie, does that shift from jewelry to bullion, does that sort of correlate with the opening of the Shanghai Exchange? Is it just easier, do you think, to buy in bullion in China these days than it was in past decades?
That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about that, and maybe that's true. But I sense that more of the reason is that that the Chinese population is looking for something to store their wealth in that's not going to get eroded, and they're very limited, right? And so maybe the opening of the Shanghai Gold Exchange has allowed that, and that's easier to do now.
I'm just wondering if we aren't kind of, I mean, we're kind of making an argument here for kind of a perfect storm for gold here. Not every component is in here yet, but we have we've got central banks around the world with strong demand for bullion, right? So you got big buyers in there at volume. You've got basically the geopolitical risk premium is higher than it's been in the previous couple of decades. And as Axel's saying, that might be a secular change, right? We then have markets that I've talked about with a lot of other experts on this program, where people are looking at the financial markets and saying, wow, we're at extreme levels of valuation here, maybe overvaluation. Maybe it's time to take some of my gains, on these high flyers and find a less loved and maybe less correlated asset to put this money into. So money's flowing into gold that way. There's everybody around the world who's seen their purchasing power of their fiat currencies get pretty much nuked over the past, post-COVID era, right? Who are looking for ways in which they can put their money in to protect their purchasing power. We have China, right, which is a huge population. They've just gotten totally zorched. The biggest asset in the world, I don't know if it still is or not, but was the Chinese real estate market, right? That's been imploding, lots of losses there. Basically, people are saying within China, okay, I can't get it's harder to get my money out of China, but I don't want to keep it in real estate. Where else can I put it that I feel good about? Well, gold's been something that we put, our money in as a store of value for centuries, maybe longer. Now it's maybe even easier to buy gold there in investable form with the Shanghai Exchange. So
And
you
then
have
there was
that
also the
going on.
explosion of all their private wealth management products, that were over-levered, and that's been a whole saga as well.
Yeah, you've got, and so you've basically just got a rippling contagion going on there. So there's like this big pressure for safety trade. And as Axel started here, maybe the smallest factor right now is that speculators may be dipping their toe into the pool now, right? And there's more of
Just
that
one,
capital.
yeah, one caveat. I wouldn't call it perfect storm at this stage. What the key ingredient for a perfect storm that's missing is a hard landing, right? You really, or a systemic risk event. So it's that said, gold tends to do well when it anticipates easing, right? And then obviously, if a crisis were to happen or a more significant downturn were to happen, the market would price in a more severe cut. Real rates would come down more. That may be the perfect storm. Now, at the same time, of course, you want to be in the space before the S hits the fan, right? Before the perfect storm comes. And in some ways, ever since Powell shifted from higher to longer to this easing bias, even though he hasn't cut and these cuts get priced out, gold is doing well. So it's the anticipation. And conversely, right, in last decade, when we were at zero and there was always the anticipation we might have lifted at some point, that was a significant headwind. So perversely, even though we haven't had any cuts, it's been favorable for the price of gold.
So, okay. And I actually was working my way up to the Fed moving in and starting to do easing and all that stuff again, which of course you just took it. It's great. The one other factor that I would add too, if I heard you guys correctly, is the US buyer, the US retail buyer hasn't really showed up that much yet, right? I think it was you, Jamie, saying that if you're looking at flows into the ETFs, into and out of the ETFs, that it's not really at a big fervor right now in the GLDs of the world, the big precious metals ETFs. Is that true?
Yeah, no, not at
Yes.
all. Yeah, no. And Peter is the one that reports on that every day to us. And maybe you have something to say on that. I mean, maybe it's ticked up, but something that you can see with a microscope. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we saw consistent outflows in the North American ETFs in the first 3 months of the year, 2 months really, the first 2 months, and it was constantly out of our most of those products, but that was offset by the central bank buying, and that was really what all the support was. The generalist investor and the North American investor moves a lot quicker and moves in and out of products, and so they were definitely making a bet against the gold price.
And to
Okay.
just qualify
That's
that
like
just a tad, we have one of these products, and that has had slight inflows throughout the year, bucking the trend. But we are in some way small fish in that pond. So most of the products have had outflows.
Right.
So
So
that's
it's
it's in contrast to 2020, because in 2020 there was inflow of 1,000 tons of gold into ETFs, and we saw the gold price go up by $400 a ton. And so that I feel like that move was really driven by, the U.S. retailer, the U.S. financial investor, and this drive is clearly not driven by that, this
Right. So,
move.
and sorry, can I add one more thing? Is also in the last month, we've seen a lot of volatility around the inflows and outflows of the ETFs, where it was constantly out for the first 2 months. And now we're seeing big changes either way over the last 2 to 3 weeks that are changing the way we're looking at it.
Well, that's sort of where I was trying to get here. So, okay, so the U.S. investor is sitting out the party so far, but as I said earlier, we know that Wall Street loves momentum, right? So, Peter, you said that the retail side made the wrong bet, or at least retail and institutional side made the wrong bet in Q1. Now they're seeing price take off. Maybe you're seeing the early signs of, okay, we got to switch our strategies here. Do you see it as being relatively bullish that gold performed as well as it did with those outflows?
I think we would like to believe that. I think it could go either way. But my argument would be that the central bank buying has supported the gold price where we're at. We haven't seen the inflows that we expect from the generals. It doesn't take a lot, as we've said earlier, for these sort of the North American investors to start piling in, which would take things to the next level. So I my belief, and I think a lot of the anticipation was a lot of the selling really was the Fed basically telling us that they weren't going to cut rates. And so people were saying, well, we're not going to jump in until we sort of see the move where interest rates are going to start going lower. That hadn't happened, hasn't happened, but I think most people anticipate that it's going to happen. It's more of a question of when, not if. And so when that starts happening, the flows start coming and that pushes things to the next level.
Okay, so anything can change from here, but we are ticking off lots of boxes on our perfect storm here, right? So if that were to happen, that's another important box on the checklist. And Axel, I don't even know. I mean, to your earlier point, maybe we can tick the Fed box, right? Because the fact that the Fed rate cut probability is going down, we're going to have more of this environment where the market is continuing to anticate a cut, right? The suspense keeps building.
Powell is clearly a person who likes to run the economy hot if it can sustain that. And so the inflation miss, unforgivable in my view for the Fed, that they had got them to take a step back and saying, oh my God, we don't want to have a repeat of the 1970s. That said, I call it a mission accomplished speech when Powell spoke last October. He has been no longer concerned about a repeat of the 70s. And so he again has this bias that, oh, if we don't have too much inflation, we can ease. And of course, the market has been pricing out these rate cuts as inflation numbers have been coming in a little stronger than expected, but they haven't come in that strong that it would change the view of the Fed. Powell is convinced that they are restrictive and that we don't need to be quite as restrictive. And either it is that he thinks inflation is no longer an issue, or of course, at the other end of the spectrum, and we haven't touched on that, he sees an underlying problem.
Right, he's
Um,
worried.
as a reminder, a year ago, the Fed gave some emergency measures to small banks that had mismanaged things. And those programs, the Federal Reserve would like to phase out. Well, they can only phase them out, in my view, if they give them relief on the interest rate side. And so they might have, it's just the cognitive bias that they have. They want to ease to make sure they don't have trouble down the road. Ultimately, I think what we're getting is an attempt to micromanage all kinds of aspects of the economy, safeguarding the small banks while at the same time easing or keeping tight. They have so many conflicting goals that that at the end of the day, they lose sight of it, and they'll march happily until something breaks, and then they'll cut again.
Okay.
But actually, well, don't you also think that, you know, the fact that we're running a fiscal deficit of prehistoric proportions in a very strong economy with high debt to GDP ratios sort of pushes the Fed into a corner at some point? And like, so, I mean, how do you fund this, and what are the rise in interest rates do to their balance sheet, right? I mean, how are they managing that, and what is their long-term view on that, and how does that influence, you know, what they're saying and doing?
Well, there's our view, and I think the view of most people, that it does have a tailwind effect to the economy. Yeah. When it comes to the Fed's view, they have been rather silent on that topic. And Powell in particular, he doesn't want to step onto that turf. And beyond that, I simply don't know what his view is on that, because he clearly does try to stay away from that. But at the same time, the traditional central bank reaction would be fiscal policy is more active, so we have to be more restrictive on the monetary side. But Powell has not even given a hint, if I'm not mistaken, of articulating that.
All right. So I'm biting my tongue, trying not to get into the whole fiscal dominance discussion, which I've been having pretty much with almost every other guest on this program here, but it's a very good point, Jamie. Okay. So we have this, I'm going to say preponderance of positive, elements here for gold. Now, who knows what's going to happen in the future? And the metals moved pretty far, pretty fast. There could very easily be some pullback coming up here soon, maybe even before this video even airs. Who knows? There's a lot of reasons to expect that, this breakout that we're seeing, this price breakout that we're seeing, it could be the real deal. In other words, there's been precious metals people, I don't need to tell you this, who for much of the past decade, have kind of been waiting for gold to break out of its long-term trading ranges. And, there's been this sort of multi-year, decade-long cup and handle. I'm sure you guys are familiar with that and whatnot. So who knows what's going to happen, but we're going to see. But gold right now seems to have a lot of tailwinds behind it. And if the U.S. retail investor shows up at some point, that could add an even greater tailwind to it. So moving on, I want to get to the miners, but real quick. So we've been talking about gold. Gold moved, had a pretty good move before silver even started to react. Silver's kind of been making up for lost time in the past week or two here. But any comments you guys want to have about silver before we move on to the miners?
Peter, do you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the silver price obviously has a more speculative feel to it than the gold price. I think there's a lot of investors that believe that the leverage that the silver price has is where you can make a lot of money. I'd say that the industrial portion of silver, as it's more of a byproduct than it is a pure mineable commodity, mm-hmm. makes it a little more interesting. But we do believe that there is a lot of leverage there to the silver price and the potential for that to outperform.
Okay, and so how given gold's move, Where would you sort of think silver should be right now? I'm not going to say this is a prediction on your part.
Yeah, but no. So, historically we've looked, we've spent a lot of time looking at different data, and the gold-silver ratio is something that everybody looks at, or has looked at historically. Historically, it was at 50 times gold-silver. It's been in the 85 to 90 range for months now. Again, very odd number that we, is not really that supportive, but we've seen that trend moving down from 90 to around 83 to 84 right now. That we just need to see a little bit of move. It could go well below 83 as gold continues to rise, but silver could very easily outperform at that point. So it could go, down to the 60s and 70s, where, still above the historical level. I'm not entirely convinced we'll ever get back to that 50 times, but it should get lower from where we are right now.
Okay, do some general mental math for me, just ballpark. We
Yeah.
get down into the 65, like what does that put a silver price at?
Oh man, that puts silver 20, 2300. So it puts silver probably at $50 or $60.
Okay, so I don't let me put words in your mouth, but I kind of hear you saying you wouldn't be shocked to see silver at $50 to $60 if the gold to silver ratio kind of move down nearer its historical average.
Correct. Correct.
Okay. All right. And yeah, just a reminder for folks, the day we're talking, silver's trading, I think it closed at 2850 today, something like that. So that's more than a doubling. Okay. All
Yeah,
right.
the other thing I think that Peter is right on is the speculative nature of it, and we haven't seen the pickup in holdings of gold in holdings in gold ETFs, but we have seen a pickup in holdings in silver ETFs. So it does seem like the speculative interest has jumped into that a little bit. So that's interesting. And the other thing is that we've seen silver, trailed gold to begin with, and then it has started to rise, in the last several months. And that seems to be coinciding with this kind of resurgence in commodity prices that we've seen around the globe, which may be the awakening of the China industrial capacity again. So, and then also, I mean, we're certainly spending a lot on infrastructure build in the US as well. So, that silver definitely has a much more industrial component to it. And as we see the industrial economy pick back up, I think you should see that pick back up as well. And the other thing is that the spending within China, they're looking to put more money into power infrastructure. And although, both they dominate in wind production and solar production, and even those are kind of a loss-making businesses, it's become a strategic initiative of the central government to invest further in those industries and build out their power infrastructure. And so the solar panels are becoming one of the bigger demands of silver, and we should see that continue to grow as well.
Okay, so in this market, I know the silver market from an above ground standpoint is tiny compared to gold, I believe. You're nodding, Peter. Okay, good. Now, I think we use a lot of what's mined every year, largely commercially. But because there's growing commercial demand, as Jamie was just telling us, and now maybe there's growing investor demand if speculators are coming back into this market. Is it the type of market that, again, a little bit of incremental demand goes a far way in throwing the price around because it's small
Yes, I mean,
or not?
historically, the silver market has been a way for people to play the leverage, and it's undoubtedly if we have some generalist investors that decide to make the move into silver, it could take off in a way that we historically have seen.
Yeah, the one caveat I'd like to throw in there, and I'm just reframing what Peter and Jamie said, is because of the strong industrial use in an economic downturn, silver often doesn't perform as well as gold does, because gold is this pure play against central banks. Whereas if you have an economic downturn, especially if it's a global one, silver can suffer. Now, if we have more of a soft landing, maybe they're more, you'd call them a price to the perfect storm type of thing, right? Maybe that's more suitable to silver. Keep in mind that silver is very, very volatile. And so obviously that's what makes it attractive to some people. As a long-term investor, you want to keep that in mind as well.
Okay. Yep. And I'm glad that you just look, let's call a spade a spade. Everything we're talking about is volatile, right? Even gold on a relative basis is a pretty volatile asset. Silver, super volatile. The miners, which we're going to talk about in just a second, crazily volatile at times, right? So these are things that people should, enter in with caution. Gold, again, it plays a very prudent role in a portfolio. So I'm not trying to scare people out of it by any stretch,
To
but.
just put that into somewhat more numbers, gold historically is about as volatile as the equity market. But what gold can do is that volatility can spike both to the upside and the downside. And so if one looks at it for a period where it's been well behaved, one just has to be aware of it, that it can misbehave, and that misbehavior can go against you as well. So when people invest in that, they need to be able to stomach the volatility that comes with it. And I'm sure we're going to talk about the volatility in the minus in a moment, where that can be amplified quite significantly.
Yes, and you guys wouldn't use this term. I have used the term as someone who's invested in the mining sector, that they can be widow makers. So you just have to go in being aware of that risk. And obviously, there are lots of ways to manage the risk, where you invest in the spectrum of mining, the mining sector, you know, if you use hedges, things like that. But just be aware that, you know, if your goal is to sleep soundly at night, then you want to make sure that you have, you know, put a lot of risk management around your position in the miners. And maybe this is the right segue to make. Okay, so we've just talked about how gold has this growing list of perfect storm elements building behind it. Silver is catching up and has the potential to get really interesting if it just gets back to relatively average, if we get back to a relatively average gold to silver ratio. Now, the miners historically have been looked at as, you know, a leveraged way to play the price of the metals. And one of the reasons why that is because their costs are relatively fixed. You know, and I do want to talk about the cost of what's going on in the mining sector right now, because I believe the sector has been hit with higher costs of late, with fuel costs and staffing costs and things like that. But, you know, the price of the metal can move pretty quickly, and your cost structure doesn't move nearly as quickly. So when the price of the metal moves, that gain, pretty much 100% of it hits your bottom line, right? Okay, so let's talk about the mining industry. Now, I mentioned kind of in the intro, it has been lagging in terms of the action of the metals. Is that unexpected? Is that just sort of the way it goes? Do the metals typically catch fire first and then the miners catch up later on? What are you seeing right now, I guess, as you look at the mining sector complex here? Anyone who wants to take that can chime in.
Maybe I'll give a very quick 50,000 foot view, and then I'll have Peter and Jamie chime in. So to just expand on what you indicated, right? That's the perfect theory, which of course the cost is fixed, and then you get the leverage on the way up. In practice, it has not always happened. When all energy prices go up, while mining is very energy intensive, the cost of fuel, diesel, and whatnot is super important. Other stakeholders want to have a bigger chunk. The workers want to have higher salaries. Governments want to have higher taxes when things go well. And so that sometimes dampens things. On the producer side, the companies have gotten their ship in order after the previous boom. Investors want them to clean up their house. Well, they generate so much cash that they actually have less leverage to the price of gold than they used to. And at the other end of the spectrum, on the junior miners, when they're only exploration companies, well, they don't produce yet. And so they tend to be, I call them sometimes options plays on making it big. They are subject to funding constraints. They tend to need to fund their projects. So there's some credit risk that they have. And in the higher for longer environment, they've had headwinds. As we're moving away from that, those smaller companies have been performing well. And they truly have a very high upside, but some of them will not make it. But I'll, based on that upper view, maybe I'll give it to you, Peter, and then Jamie probably has some thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, no, I'd say, you know, we've seen a lot of the inflation. You're right. The inflation was hitting the companies probably about a year ago, and we saw that happening, and with a relatively stable gold price. This increase that we've seen in the gold price over the last 3 to 6 months is dropping to the bottom line. The cost structure has stabilized. We haven't, you know, we're starting to see some reporting for over the last, you know, quarter, and the costs are not increasing at the rate of the gold. And, you know, when you get to these levels, you know, we were talking in our research meeting today, you know, there's a $40 move in the gold price of gold today. And that all drops to the bottom line, that essentially, because costs aren't going to increase that quickly. And so we're in a period where the margins are increasing as the gold price goes up at a faster rate.
Okay. And I'm curious, do you expect, like, how good is Wall Street is in pricing that in the moment versus waiting to actually see the earnings on the earnings call?
So
Yeah.
I would, Jamie, I'll say something. Jamie's done a lot of work on this, but at the end of the day, the banks have done a very poor job of predicting the gold price. And if you look at the levels that the price inputs that they're using for the price of gold is well below the current spot price. And they have become a lot more reactive in how they base their projections going forward. So Jamie, I don't know if you want to add some to that.
Yeah, no, I think Peter's right on that. Is that, I think if you look at forward earnings estimates on Bloomberg, for 2024, the gold price that a lot of the banks are using is probably, maybe some of them are up to 2,000, some of them use a forward curve, a lot of them use less. And then as you look out further to 2025, 2026, a lot of them are like well below the spot price. I mean, they might be putting the estimates in at like 1850. So they've been slow to react to this. And so just as they bring their gold price up, like what you see on the Bloomberg terminal as far as earnings estimates will go up significantly. I think like stepping back too and looking at this and sort of understanding where investors are, I think you have to look at the last run that we had in 2000. And that was a pretty dramatic run that we saw during COVID, where gold shot up and the equity valuation shot up significantly. And everybody was betting on, this is a great trade. We'll jump in there. The gold miners are going to make us a ton of money. And they really fell flat. But I think that that was not unique to the gold miners in the sense that every industry in the world had significant inflation. And so we saw every dollar, the gold price went up. The cost structure of the business went up. So they actually delivered no margin expansion in that environment. And so I think that as we look forward, that most investors are once bitten, twice shy, and are not jumping into this right away. And I think that, they're going to want to see some cash flowing to the bottom line. And, I think in this environment, you will see that. I think that, that if we're looking at free cash flows this year, there's a lot of these mid-cap companies that are going to generate double-digit cash flows. I see a lot of the companies where it's projected to generate 20% cash flow yields, that looks pretty healthy. But I think that, I think people will be slower to get into it, and they're going to want to see that cash hit the balance sheet before they dive in.
Okay, so I'm going to pull up a chart here. This is basically showing that the gold miners are trading at a not even, yeah, what's the right way to say this? Were they trading at a premium to gold, the gold price before, and now they're sort of trading we're talking about the ratio here, but basically it is much lower over the past decade than it was in previous decades, right?
Definitely.
And that may speak very well, Jamie, to maybe just sort of a loss of confidence in the sector that, like, hey,
Yeah.
the sector, these companies just aren't that well run. I'm once bitten, twice shy, like you said, right? So maybe it is sort of in a show me state at this point in
Yeah.
time.
And Adam, if I can just chime in on this. So
Yeah.
the index that's shown here is the underlying index to GDX, which obviously has the large producers. One of the challenges of the large producers is when they were told, and companies tend to do what their investors want them to do. So when they were told to get their house in order, they rather than acquiring companies, they focused on cash flow. Well, the mine life in gold mining tends to be fairly short. Now, obviously, they continuously try to, within the properties that they have, they try to find new gold, but as they deplete their mines, right, they generate all this cash, and as I indicated earlier, they have less of a leverage to the price of gold. And in the meantime, it's been, well, when are they going to acquire some new ounces? When are they going to acquire some companies? And I believe they were waiting for valuations to be lower. Well, they have been lower. Now they're starting to pick up, so it is possible that they're starting to get kind of cold feet and gonna accelerate the acquisition. But what will happen in the meantime, I believe, is that when we see some of that, and then Peter and Jamie can talk to more of that, is that we will see mergers in the mid-tier sectors because they can't wait for the big guys to eat them. So they'll just have to build new big mining companies. And I think some of what we see in the pricing action is some of the churn and some of the opportunities may not even be in the biggest companies.
All right, and Peter and Jamie, I want to have you hear you guys react to that. But in your answers, let's just say the gold price hangs out where it is right now, right? At the high 23s, maybe 24. Would you expect at that level that at the M&A activity would just have to pick up for the reasons that Axel mentioned?
Yeah, I think M&A will need to pick up, especially, well, it's interesting among the large miners. So Barrick and Newmont, those are by far the largest miners. You know, they have whatever between 4 to 6 million ounces of production. I'm actually not sure what Newmont is now with the merger with Newcrest. But if you think about trying to replace that many ounces each year, like a really large gold mine is like 350,000 ounces a year. And these guys are producing, you know, 5.5 million, 6 million ounces a year. You're having to find a huge number of large gold mines every year to replace that production, right? And these things just aren't that easy to replace. And so a lot of the big guys have also been diversifying out of gold into copper. And the reason is that there's a thematic around copper, but I think primarily the reason is they just can't find gold mines that have the size and the life of mine that they're looking for. And when you go into copper, you can invest in copper gold assets because those two metals tend to go together in what are called copper gold porphyries. They can get exposure to both those metals, and you can get a 30-year mine life out of these type of deposits. And I think that's a lot of the big guys are focused on that. The more pure exposure to the gold price is really happening in the mid-cap section, where you have producers that are producing between, you know, anywhere from 300,000 ounces a year to 2 million ounces a year, where these guys have the opportunity to add very, very accretive gold mines that can incrementally change their production, or they can discover new gold resources that can incrementally change their production, and they stay true to being pure gold exposure. So I think what we're seeing more M&A activity among the mid-cap sector, who are going after maybe some of the smaller companies, than we are in the large cap.
And just to kind of reiterate, what we're calling mid-cap companies in the broader market, the majority of them are small cap in,
They're
you
really
know,
micro cap. Yeah, I mean, the gold
micro
mining
cap in
is so
general. And so
small.
it's a shocking one of this interesting, you were talking earlier, and I was waiting until we got to the miners, but you were talking about how if the generalist investor moves into the gold market or silver market, they could really push prices higher. In the mining sector, we were at a conference at the end of February, early March. This is right during the period where NVIDIA, so we were talking Mag 7, NVIDIA was increasing, you know, 40%. The market cap increase of NVIDIA in the beginning of the year was greater than all of the mining sector combined. And I'm not just talking gold. It's, you know, it's most of the mining companies. So that just tells you, if you just in the gold sector, if you can get a certain amount of that money, it doesn't even have to be that money anywhere, that could overwhelm initially the market.
Okay. And I don't want to over exaggerate here, but in past bull runs in the mining sector space, you do have stocks that basically can deliver like crypto type returns, right? You know, meme stock returns, right? Like 1,000% returns, right? And not saying this is guaranteed. I'm not saying every stock does this. But when the mania gets going, when the capital does start flowing into the space, because these companies are so small, as you're talking about, there is the potential for kind of these gargantuan returns if the company kind of hits everything right,
No,
correct?
I mean, no doubt. You look at our returns in 2020 on a relative basis. We're looking for multiple. Yeah, we were up, I think, 60% in 2020 relative to the market being up 20 or 30, or the rest of the general market. We are looking for multiples of return on our investment rather than just a market, saving, S&P type return. That's when the gold market turns, we expect these gold equities to make a bigger return.
Okay, great.
The other thing,
Yeah, go
to
ahead.
Peter's point on that, is the liquidity within the mining sector has really dried up. And, you know, so the door to get in is very small, and the door to get out is very small. And so that leads to volatile price action. And so as we start to see money flow in, it just doesn't take a large capital flow to send these stocks like significantly higher.
And just so that my compliance doesn't lock me up, we should just emphasize again, right?
The risk.
Part of the reason it goes up is because it can also go down quite sharply. And
well, I see it's a safe, it's a door going in and out, right?
Yes. But to give in a sense of the environment, right? In our space, we focus more on the junior end of things. The higher for longer environment, we underperform significantly. Then when the floodgates were, if they were to open, then the kind of the junior portfolio historically anyways would outperform. And then you have it a bit more muffled, so to speak, on the producers, especially since the producers have a little less than they historically have had. But absolutely, right? If there is money flowing into that space, it can take off. And it's one of the reasons why speculators historically were attracted before they had crypto and Mag 7 type of opportunities. I kind of like it that they haven't been around as much because it might make a rally more sustainable. But I do think with the rise we've had in the price of gold, there is some significant catching up that the miners might very well do.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I want to, in just a moment, talk about specifically what you guys do there at Merck Investments, just so the audience knows, kind of it really, truly understands your credentials here, because you run a fund for investing in gold, ONZ ounce. I mean, you know that market really well. You also manage a mining fund. And there's some interesting things going on with that, not just with the product itself, but kind of with the dynamics of the industry. So I want to give you a chance to explain that in just a sec. Real quick, I was looking at a presentation that you guys just gave, and there were a couple of kind of key things about the mining industry that you guys were focused on. I think it's worth just spending a minute or two highlighting that for the audience here. These were both, I think, sort of challenges the industry faces, but they also create, I think, maybe a little bit of an inefficient market that makes savvy investors, gives them the potential to get better returns. These are things like there's a lot of with the rise of passive investing, there's sort of a dearth of analysts that really understand this space the way that there used to be in previous years. There's definitely a shrinking pool of talent in the industry of, like, geologists and things like that limit the space. There's permitting challenges. So anyways, I want to give you guys a chance to talk about some of that stuff. Maybe let's start with this challenge of a lot of the analysts on Wall Street that really understood the mining space. There just aren't as many around these days as there used to be. Is that true?
Yeah, no, I think, I think they're aging out, and the sector has driven them out in some ways. Maybe I'll start by just maybe sort of talking a little briefly about our background. I've been managing ASA now for 5 years. Jamie's been on board for almost over two. And prior to that, I spent 10 years at Franklin Templeton traveling all over the world looking at the sites as the Golden House. Jamie was at Invesco for another 10 years prior to that, but that's where we met, visiting these sites with companies, getting on the ground, checking things out. We have a long history, probably 17 to 20 years each, focusing on this sector, knowing who to talk to, who the right companies are talking to, knowing the right people are talking to. So we have an expertise that's it's almost unrivaled relative to some of these other people we do. So maybe Jamie, you want to talk about the passive investing. And all the analysts that we grew up with, a lot of them are not around anymore. And a lot of the guys.
Yeah, I know that is true. It's been, well, there's a slide that sort of explains it, is that, the industry in the move to passive, I mean, it's been something that's affected capital markets broadly. And we've seen contractions across the industry, but specifically within this sector, there's been a combination of the move to passive and the underperformance of the resource sector in general, really since the commodity boom that we saw in the early 2000s. And as a result of that, a lot of the natural resource focused investors and analysts are no longer in the industry. And so we've seen that, like at Peter's fund, there used to be two people running it. now there's one person that's actually running two natural resource funds. And I've seen the same thing at my shop and at some other prior shops where there's really been a shrinking of talents in that area. And one thing that that's done is that there's just not the eyeballs to look at some of these earlier opportunities. And we actually like that because there's less competition and there's less capital chasing it. And so we're able to structure investments in that early stage space that have maybe some better return characteristics for our investors. And then we like to help those companies grow to the point at which they become picked up within the passive money and are more accessible to the larger institutional investors and passive money as well. So that's kind of been one of the underlying premises of our investment strategy going forward. And it's worked out pretty well.
Maybe we should take just a brief step back because most people are not that intimately familiar with this space. The rise of passive investing, what that has done is it's given a valuation premium to the large cap companies. And the way we look at that is that by focusing on the smaller cap segment of the market, there's not potential for disproportionate returns as we help these companies institutionalize. So we often come in pre-production, development, exploration companies. Even the open-end products where Jamie and Peter used to work, they often have a very small allocation there because when they have to take into account outflows, and when they have outflows, they have to liquidate something. Often it's more difficult to liquidate these small companies. And so we have a closed-end fund where we don't have daily flows. We can focus on these small ones. Now, not all of them will make it, but to the extent that they make it and are successful, and we've had some of those, and we part of the reason we're doing it is because we think there are going to be many more, is that as they go along in their life cycle, there is a disproportional pickup in valuation as they make it into the indices. And maybe Jamie, if you want to add to that a little bit.
Yeah, no. So one of the interesting facts of the mining industry as well is we participate more in the early stage, and the capital, the companies in the early stage are users of capital. They're not producers of capital. They're not producing any cash flow. And so therefore they need external funding to get right, their business.
And sorry to interrupt, but that's because they're out there literally wildcat, like they're digging and seeing if they're going to find gold. They're exploring.
We don't really invest in that stage. We normally invest in companies that have actual discoveries
development, right?
But well, they need to drill them out and then they need to develop the asset.
Yeah.
Okay. But passive money can't deploy capital into deals, right? They can only buy stocks in the open market. And so we've seen a drying up of capital available to these companies. And so we come in and we like to cut good deals with these guys and help them progress their operations. And ultimately, they are at the point at which they're, you know, producing cash flow and are able to be added into the more of these passive index and be picked up by a lot of the larger institutional buyers.
Okay. And sorry to interject, but this is kind of on this next topic phase that we're getting to. I just want to make sure that folks really get this point, which is, as I understand what you guys are saying and what you do there with your fund, is you're playing an important role in nurturing this sector because you're basically taking the folks, it sounds like mostly at the development stage, who have a discovery, but are in the process of creating an operating mine out of it, right? Which is very cash burn high at that point in time. Like you were saying, Jamie, right? They're just, you know, putting in all the infrastructure to build the mine and get the operations there and get them up and running. And they need the capital to do that. If they don't, we talked about how little capital there is in this space. Without players like you there, it really compromises the ability of this space to get from discovery to production, where they can then, that company gets capital from the passive funds, right? You're helping people cross that chasm, basically.
And of course, we don't do it out of charity.
Not many people that participate in this either, because it's hard, right? Like, we are very selective in who we choose to invest with. And a lot of the teams that we've invested with have like remarkably long track records of doing this. And, you know, And so the selection of the team and the asset and knowing the jurisdiction they're investing in is key, because it's not easy to make these things succeed. But when they do succeed, specifically in this environment where there's a dearth of capital in this early stage investing, the returns are huge. You know, and I would say that in, you know, 20 years ago, I don't think that the returns were as big as they are today, because there was more capital looking at that and there's more people willing to invest in that. But it's very limited now. In fact, a lot of the developers have resorted to just getting funded by royalty companies who were taking a chunk, you know, or really taking the first cash flows off the asset. You know, so there's very few, there's very limited risk capital in the industry right now.
And we like to consider ourselves as partners with the companies. We're not just investors, we're partners. We're helping develop. We also have relationships with other well-capitalized groups that we make sure that actually have probably better, more capital than we do. So we know and can guarantee that there's a better chance that there's support along the way when the further capital needs to be raised.
Yeah. Sorry for stepping on you there earlier. I do just want to make the point. We don't do this out of charity. We do this because there's a potential for disproportionate returns, right? And of course, we can't say, quote unquote, guarantee. The folks that we see participate in these deals, and we have gotten to know over the years quite well, are folks who have long-term capital as well. They tend to be private investors, family offices that have successfully invested in that space. But there is a lot of capital that's no longer there. And so fund like ours does play an important role in helping to, quote unquote, institutional these funds. And then the idea is that in the next funding round, then they're big enough for the mutual funds, for example, to participate, and other players that tend to come in later as they make their way towards being ready for the indices.
Okay, great. Yeah, like as I said, I see you guys as really kind of helping companies cross the chasm, right, from super early wildcatting stage to get to that point where they can get picked up.
Right? Because there's a valuation pickup in that process, right? That's right. Why we focus on that space.
Yeah. So, but the reason why I'm focusing on this is because of some of the inside baseball you're going to share with us in just a minute, because we want to make sure that there are players that continue to play the role that you play in there to help companies get from tiny to sustainable. Real quick before I do, I just mentioned them earlier. I just want to just spend 30 seconds on this and then we can move on. But there are some other additional challenges in the space, which make, you know, the ability of seasoned guys like you to kind of help focus on, you know, where the winners are likely to be even more important, are two challenges I mentioned earlier. One was the dearth of talent. And here's a chart here from your recent presentation, which kind of blows my mind. It basically just shows that, you know, the world, maybe ex-China, right, is just pumping out a lot fewer mining engineers, just less, a lot less people seem to be going into this space generationally that did before.
And the y-axis is not thousands. These are the numbers, just to be clear on that.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, yeah. Really? it's just hundreds? Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's 100 people and all of Australia became mining engineers in 2018. That's pretty abysmal. I mean,
that is shocking to me.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, it's the talent pool was really shrinking. And I mean, there's also, there's other data in there too about, you know, the retirement of the baby boomers, which I think a lot of the world is experiencing in other industries. And there's just not the people coming up behind them to jump into this. And then there's just the, you know, as we've seen the environmental movement, which has just been lambasted the, you know, the mining industry. And, you know, even though they seem to want us to dig all the, you know, copper and rare earth metals out of the ground to make windmills and electric cars, they don't understand that they need us. I think that whole movement has pushed people away from the industry as well, as it's a dirty industry, you know, don't go into mining. And so none of the young people want to go into it. It's, you know, it's a 70.
It's hard work.
It's hard work. Yeah. 70% of the respondents from colleges, you know, said that they definitely wouldn't go into it or probably wouldn't go into the mining industry, you know, so that doesn't bode well. And then there's generally just in the Western world, there's a huge dearth of engineering talent. And, you know, we've seen that with, I think, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is an oxymoron, But anyways, that there's just not enough people to do these industrial projects around the US and actually put this money to work. And so it's the mining companies are having to, in the Western world, are having to compete for talent in that sort of environment. And so one thing that we've found that's really important is finding strong leaders within the industry and aligning ourselves with them, because those leaders know people within the regions that they work, and they're able to recruit good talent. And then those people know other great talent who can be, you know, mining engineers, electricians, and whatever you have. And everybody wants to be part of a good team. And so it starts at the top, and finding someone that can put together a good team is really, really important in this industry right now.
Yeah. And I can't stress that enough, right? We talk about all these opportunities. Of course, it's important that there's gold in the ground, but it is at least as important that there's a good management team. You don't want to give money to somebody who says, hey, I've got a bunch of gold in the ground, and doesn't have a track record of executing on that. There are so many things that are going to go wrong in the process. And then investing in a team that has a proven track record makes it a lot easier.
And so we've gone so far in our investments too, where we've invested with teams who have shell companies that don't even hold a project yet. And we are there funding them, saying, we'll help you go look for a project. We'll back you guys. And then they'll search all over the world and try to find a project. And, you know, then they'll vend a project into the company. And we found that that's a very successful way to invest in the sector.
Okay. All right. And folks, there's a logic to all this, so don't worry. Hang with me just for one last sec. Then there was permitting that I heard you guys talk about, the challenges there. I pulled this one slide from your presentation, which basically is just showing average lead time for, I guess, permitting, getting all the permits you need for mines around the world.
It's the average lead time from exploration to production is 15 years globally. The governments take forever. You know, there's reasons for it, but they make it very hard, and you need to have the right people to push this through. And if you don't, you could be a fatal flaw to developing a project. And as you can see, you know, these are commodities. This isn't just, you know, gold. It's all the different mining commodities. The speed at which these projects are being developed versus the speed at which the usage of these commodities doesn't match. And so there's a dearth of projects and a dearth of commodity, volume of commodity that needs to be found to be actually manage what we see, what we need globally in the world.
So Peter, does that make you think, as I've heard this from other natural resource investors, does that make you think that we are sort of on a collision course at some point for some sort of supply crunch here, because demand has grown faster than supply over the next?
Yes. Okay. I mean, it's been happening for a while. And, you know, we saw it in the early 2000s with China, with this growth of China and the need for supply. But I think regardless, if prices are going to increase because the value, the cost to get out of the ground is also increasing too. So everything's leading towards a kind of an uplift in prices.
All right. So if I can tie this into a bow to get to the topic I want to close on here, which is we have all of these factors that we've just sort of dialed through here that say that it looks like it may become more challenging to get ounces out of the ground going forward, and for operational reasons, for, you know, the inefficiencies of the sector, it may just get harder to actually get your hands on these ounces, and or the ounces you can get your hands on, are the price of it's going to go higher because of the scarcity that is likely to come from these reasons. Plus, if the world continues the way that it's going, where fiat currencies are losing their purchasing power and people get more nervous about that, there's more competition for these ounces worldwide than there used to be. We briefly mentioned the Shanghai Exchange earlier, but there's a lot more demand in the East for gold globally than there used to be, you know, 50 years ago. If you're somebody who is thinking about getting some exposure to precious metals, there's an argument to say, well, don't wait forever, because all these factors are going to drive the price higher while you sit and wait. And if you own precious metals right now, a lot of these factors say, hey, you might want to consider holding on to this stuff for the long run because it has a pretty good appreciation story ahead of it. So now to get to the final closing point, which is, as I understand this, and I'm going to let you guys educate me and the viewers here at the same time. As I said earlier, your funds like yours play an important role in basically keeping in fostering this sector, right? By providing capital at this critical level to get people from tiny to sustainable. But it's not easy. I mean, not only is it not easy because investing is hard and not every company you back is a winner, but there's stuff that's happening in the industry that is putting the industry itself at a certain risk. Axel, maybe we can start with you. Do you want to kind of share with folks what you guys are dealing with right now?
So just for context, we manage currently about 1.3 billion in gold and gold mining. And on the gold mining side, we manage a closed-end fund, ASA Gold and Precious Metals Limited. It trades on the New York Stock Exchange, symbol ASA. And as of when we're talking, it has 390 million in assets under management. Because it's been volatile, who knows by the time you publish it, where we will be. But I indicated earlier that this fund is what's called a closed-end fund, which means we don't have daily inflows and outflows. Yet you can trade at any minute the New York Stock Exchange is open, which means it trades not at the net asset value, which an ETF would, because there's no natural arbitrage mechanism as you'd have in GDX or your favorite S&P 500 index funds. And so ASA, like most closed-end funds, tends to trade at a discount. And it doesn't really matter for many investors because they buy at a discount, they sell at a discount. ASA was founded, by the way, in 1958, so it's been around for a while. It was founded in the time in South Africa because people couldn't invest in gold in the US. It was reincorporated in Bermuda in 2004. Peter started managing it in the beginning of April of 2019. And we repositioned it into a fund that invests rather than large cap index hubbing type of nature into the small cap space. And so what has happened is that these closed-end funds sometimes attract so-called activist investors that don't really care about gold, but they do care about that discrepancy between the market price and the net asset value. And they have a toolbox that with which they try to, quote unquote, capture the discount, close the discount. And without getting into too much detail, the challenge that these tools have is that for ASA, they're not particularly suitable. And one of the more obvious ones is that sometimes these funds have a tender offer, say, okay, whoever wants to give their shares back can get back at NAV. Well, the problem with that is the underlying portfolio has to be sold when you invest in these very illiquid mining companies, especially if it's known in the market that somebody will be selling. There can be significant pricing pressure. On the upside, by the way, when these funds trade at, say, a 15% or so discount on the this fund can move 10% in a week. So without depleting the assets of this fund, this could happen. What we think might happen to just kind of cut to the chase of it, if you go through the various things that one can do to address concerns of an activist, we believe that the activists that we have will come to the conclusion that none of these things are working. And then they'll try to liquidate this product. And there are a few problems with that is, the first one is that we believe that most investors in this fund actually like what we do in the product and would like this to continue to be the case for many years to come. The other one is, of course, when you liquidate it, you have the same issue that you may not be able to sell at a good price. And so we have a shareholder meeting coming up on April 26, where we're asking investors that are in the fund to make sure that they vote with the management. We actually think that we will prevail. It's very important, though, that everybody votes because the strength of the vote matters. These activists have a lot of capital, and they may stick around. Whereas if we can send them a strong message, then they might look for other pastures. I'll stop here. There's a lot more. We can talk many hours about this topic.
Okay. Yeah. So just to help people understand, I'm going to make an analogy. You can tell me if it's near the mark or not, but it's like you guys have this factory, right? And the factory makes mining companies, and over time, you think the factory is going to produce a lot of value over time, and you're doing a good job right now managing the factory. You've had this party come along that is basically saying, "Hey, I'm going to, I'm guessing they bought a certain percent stake in the fund or whatever to be able to, push things around a little bit." They're saying like, "Well, hey, we there's this discount in the near term where we could basically just shut the factory down, sell it for parts, and we as the activist investor will walk away with more money than we put in. And that's good for us, the activist investor, but it has killed the factory, right? All the future value the factory could have produced, not going to happen here, right?" So it feels, and I understand how this happens in corporate America all the time. I'm familiar with it. I've worked for companies that where an investor would come in and do this has happened before. But am I capturing the spirit of sort of what's going on there?
Yes, I think definitely. And especially also translating this to the corporate world. In many ways, closed-end funds are more vulnerable than the closed-end than the corporate world. There are several rules that are stacked against closed-end funds. That activist has about 15%, 16%. And many people don't vote. I mean, who of your audience is voting the sort of things that come in the mail? Most of the stuff gets thrown away. So
I
these
get a lot
proxy
of them. I'd
battles,
never vote.
yeah, exactly. These proxy battles tend to get very expensive. Also, one of the things that happens is one of our, just as an example, I don't want to name any names, but we have an investment advisor that loves what we do. They have a lot of investors that invest in the fund through them. But as part of their policy, they're not voting the shares of those investors. Now, part of it is, and I'm not going to put words into their mouth, but it's work, right? If you delegate it to the investor, then there's only liability that you have if you vote those shares. So they're just not voting those shares. And many of the retail investors that are underlying investors, it's very difficult to reach them. And then conversely, of course, you have some people that never look at their statements and whatnot. Also, when you have one of these contested proxies, what happens is that the activist and we send out separate proxy cards. Whichever card you vote last counts, and it throws away the previously voted
Previous
card.
one.
And so let's say somebody doesn't like the activist, and then they vote on the activist card against the activist. Well, if they've previously voted for us on our card, it throws away that vote. And so it's there's these quirks in the system that make it very, very difficult for the company to succeed, and much easier for the activists to have a disproportionate influence, even if they have a fairly moderate stake. And of course, here again, right, this is a company founded in 1958. We have many investors that have been in the fund for decades, others that have come on since we've started managing the fund. And I mean, I think I don't need to tell anybody anything. Most investors cannot access the sort of opportunities in which we invest in. And I'm not saying that everybody should invest in those things because it's a unique risk profile. But if you want to invest in that space, our vehicle is one of the few publicly available vehicles that provides access in that. Indeed, it's the only one in this particular format. It's all but impossible to access that as a retail investor otherwise. And again, it doesn't mean that it's suitable for every retail investor. It's very volatile, but it is something that for certain types of investors is the right thing. And those investors that do it, we as the management, and I'm also on the board believes that all the shareholders should be asked what they want to do rather than an activist only. And by the way, to just, I didn't mention it earlier, when this activist first showed up, we reached out to them just as we reach out to all the investors. They didn't engage. They didn't have any requests, any demands. And so one day they come and say, "Hey, let's kick out that board and we'll do something different." And unfortunately, that is not a good basis for discussion, and it makes this entire ordeal rather expensive.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry you're going through this. I'm taking away from this. I'm sure you're limited in what you can say, but I'm taking away from this that that's sort of like this ecosystem of, mining, precious metals mining investing, especially for on the retail side, is sort of under threat here at this point in time? Because obviously, if what you guys do gets dismantled, as you just said, sort of, you know, there's not many people doing this, and the industry itself suffers, and investors have fewer choices, and companies that might otherwise make it may not. So my big question to you is, so people that are watching here, if they're motivated by this, I mean, obviously, if you're an ASA shareholder, you've definitely got a direct stake in this, so they're motivated. But I think anybody who just sort of cares about the ability to invest and have this space continue to grow and strengthen, it just spells opportunity for all the reasons that we were just talking about 10 minutes ago. So yeah, let's start with the ASA investor and then just the general viewer. What can people do if they want to vote their position here?
Sure. Well, I mean, three types of investors, so to speak. So clearly, those who have been investors, absolutely, please vote. Then we're not selling any shares. There's nothing going to be issued. But if there is a chance that the activist is not walking away, and so if somebody thinks there's an opportunity now, in a year from now, there may be another vote. And so being an investor in a year from now is also helpful. But as you, I think, point out here, this is much bigger than ASA is. This is the industry that suffers as well. And so anybody who has an interest and a stake in this industry, I would very much encourage to have them spread the word and have people who are supportive reach out to us. And of course, I mean, shareholders, by the way, who have other views, we welcome them to reach out to us as well. We want to hear from all the shareholders. But as far as helping this industry, reach out to us and spreading the word on what's happening here with ASA, I think is very helpful, because we need to. A lot of investors are very passive, just as they like to buy index funds, right? Just as you can't just produce an electric car out of nothing. You need to mine the stuff out of the ground. You can't just create a mining company out of nothing. And so if you don't, and even if you're just interested in keeping inflation low, right? Having more mining capacity helps inflation low in different segments of this economy. So having a greater awareness of the sort of stuff that happens behind the scene, I think it's hugely helpful. But maybe Peter, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think you made a good case for what we do and how to support us.
Yeah,
All right.
no, I'll add
Go
in that
ahead.
it's, you know, it's a pretty unique structure in the space, in that I partially joined the fund because of the structure. It's a closed-end fund, so we don't have capital going in and out. And I had worked at a very large mutual fund before that, where we were more subject to flows, and it very much hamstrung how we were able to invest. And so this format enables us to invest in these companies and be good stewards of capital, and being able to hang through the hard times, and being able to fund companies through more difficult times. And then we also have more structures available for us to invest in as well. So I think that it's a very unique structure for doing this. And there's not many investors out there that have these capacities. And so we think we play a vital role, and we think that we're able to generate really outsized returns because of that, because we're not competing against a lot of capital either.
And I think I will add that I think we're able to be more thoughtful, more strategic in how we invest relative to the way we use some of the other places.
And to maybe round this out just a little bit, we are passionate about this space. And we these days, we used to do a lot on the currency side. We're these days 100% focused on gold and gold mining. Both Peter and Jamie came from shops that had many other products. And gold is just different. The risk profile is different. It's countercyclical. You need to have the right mindset. We have risk meetings that we can tailor to the space. Peter and Jamie were sitting through risk meetings in their shops and talked to their colleagues that use risk metrics that are just not applicable to the space. And so by being able to tailor the opportunity profile, the risk profile to the space, we think that there is an amazing opportunity. Now, obviously, this doesn't mean, again, that these gold miners will go up every day. Quite the contrary, there will be times when there will be severe downdrafts. But this unique risk profile also allows the sort of diversification that you can't get easily otherwise, right? If you think we might get a hard landing, but maybe you're not quite sure, right? With a fairly small allocation to AZA, you can get quite a bit of diversification because of the risk profile that the fund has.
All right. Well, we will wrap it up there. Gentlemen, I want to wish you all the best with your ongoing fight there. I sincerely hope you get the outcome that you want. I hope that any motivated viewer here takes whichever appropriate step that you laid out there, Axel, to vote their conscience and express their support, however they want to, for this industry. All right. Normally, I ask you to, you know, tell people where to go follow you and whatnot, but I think, you know, your list there of things that people could do is the right list of action items for folks to consider here. Just as we wrap up, folks, here, if you've enjoyed this great discussion about the whole precious metals complex and the inside baseball that the team here just shared with us, please let them know by hitting the like button and clicking on the red subscribe button below. I'm going to bypass my normal list of housekeeping here at the end just to wrap it up and make sure folks keep their eyes on the prize in terms of what actions they should take. I just want to say, if folks are considering investing in precious metals mining companies, in addition to looking at ASA, because the space is so volatile and, you know, all the other caveats that we put in here, especially if you don't have any prior experience investing in this space, especially if you're going to be investing in specific companies, highly recommend you do so under the guidance of a professional financial advisor. And I won't give the same long spiel I give every week, but just say, if you want to, if you don't have a good financial advisor to talk to about that, consider talking to one of the ones that Thoughtful Money endorses. And to do that, you can set up a free consultation by going to thoughtfulmoney.com. Axel, I'll let you have the last word here.
No, thanks for doing this, right? Usually I send people to merckinvestments.com, have them follow me on Twitter. ASALTD.com is actually the ASA website that has a lot of in-depth coverage on this. We do have a newsletter to sign up for and all that. But otherwise, yes, I mean, we are very excited about the space, and thank you so much for having us. This has been great.
Axel, Jamie, Peter, real pleasure to be with you guys. Thanks so much for sharing all your expertise. Axel, we'll see you soon again with the next FOMC meeting.
Yep.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks for your time.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.